Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to now.
I'm down to Anfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
I feel a little bit sorry for whoever has to follow Duncan Ferguson as the next Everton manager, even if it ends up being Wayne Rooney. He's just not going to get the fans. He's not going to understand what the club is all about like Big Dunk does. I can see it now. Rooney's press conference before his first match, he'll say something along the lines of, you know, those players, they should run themselves into the ground. Imagine if you asked a fan to put on a shirt and get out on the pitch. What would they do? Well, my players need to do that. Then he'd thump the table with his rallying call, only to be informed that Dunk's already used that line, mate. All right then, says Wayne. I'll just go out and buy the fans a drink on the morning of the game. I mean, he hasn't done that, has he? Fortunately, he might have. Welcome to the Football Podcast. Hi, Ken. Hi, Murph.
Hello.
Hey,
how are you?
How's it going?
The Winslow Hotel on Goodison Road tweeted on Saturday, massive big thanks. That's a really huge thanks to the legend that is Duncan Ferguson for buying all our customers their first drink this morning. Amazing. It was an early kickoff.
I was going to say, it's 12:30 kickoff, wasn't it? I mean, I keep calling it the breakfast kickoff, and you guys keep slating me.
See, that's clever by Big Dunk. You know, would he have done that if it was a 5:30 kickoff?
Yeah.
And who knows how much money would have gone behind the bar. In this case, he knows there's not much time. Just get a little bit behind the bar. That'll be enough to get everyone their one drink pre-match. Anyway, amazing, generous gesture. That's a measure of the man. Come on, you Blues. This is followed by claims that the former Scotland striker had done the same thing nearby at the Brick on County Road. So it seems like Dunk was going, is it too cruel to suggest his players did play against Aston Villa like the fans would have done if they were out there after having their free drinks? It is too cruel, Murph. They weren't that bad, but they were bad enough to lose the game, and it leaves them, what is it, 4 points now off the relegation zone. I don't want Everton to get relegated. I kind of like when these big teams get into these, you know, it's kind of funny to watch for a while when a big team gets in trouble and it's like, they couldn't possibly, are they too good to go down? But I don't know, none of us have seen in our lifetimes a Premier League or a First Division without Everton in there. So, you know, let's arrest this slide while we can, lads. That's my rallying call.
You better get your finger out, all right, and make sure that you get the fucking results.
I mean, a rallying call's all been good, but how many drinks have you put behind the bar at the Goodison Lane Hotel?
Zero.
That's the thing. That's the question.
Like, Ferguson is sort of... To watch him in action, and obviously he's playing to, you know, pandering a bit to the fans or whatever. But I think he understands who he's speaking to a bit better than, you know, Farhad Moshiri does. You know, Moshiri actually put out a big statement towards the end of last week, because, you know, he somehow managed to detect that all was not well in the Everton family. he was able to pick up some rumblings of discontent, and he put out a statement which includes the line, I am a private man and I do not speak publicly very often. To which, having read the statement, having laboured, battled my way to the end of this statement, I can say, the only thing I can think of to say is, thank God you don't speak very often. Because this is the most droning, like, just dull. Like, it goes on for so long and it's just so much boring business speak. I mean, it's like he has got some major headline items here. You know, the club has announced today the conversion of a £100 million loan to the club into equity, which is a clear demonstration of my commitment and greatly strengthens the balance sheet. You know,
sounds like the kind of thing the fans would like.
Yeah, I mean, it's big, you know, but and yet it just gets lost amid all this. You know, we're working on key projects, you know, strategic reviews, recruitment process, you know, working together, blah, blah, blah. The financial acumen of one of the most respected finance directors in football. You know, you're just like, God almighty, this guy, like, is this really the best that he could do? So compared to this, like, Duncan Ferguson sort of, the fans can do whatever they want. If the fans want to surround Bill Kenwright and scream at him in the car park, that's fine. It's their club. You know, if they want to pelt Aston Villa players with missiles, you know, who am I to say they shouldn't do that?
Confronting Bill Kenwright boozed up on Duncan's free booze.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm behind my pocket yet, Bill, and I'm still out of my box.
Duncan Ferguson is right about this. Like, it is the, you know, it is the fans' club. I mean, this is kind of what's been missing from the way that Moshiri runs the news today that Vitor Pereira could be the next Everton manager. And we're going to talk to Patrick Boylan of The Athletic a bit later on. But, you know, just the idea that, like, they could appoint Vitor Pereira to take over. Like, if they did that, honestly. Like,
well, why? I don't even know this guy, really, to be honest.
Well, he usually gets linked with the Everton job whenever it comes up.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Portuguese manager in his, like, late 50s, I guess. He's won the league with Porto. Not a lot of people don't, to be fair. He's won the league with Olympiacos in Greece, which, again, you know, you have to kind of go out of your way not to win the league with Olympiacos. He has also won the league with Shanghai SIPG in China, which I think is his longest stint anywhere out in Shanghai. He, you know, most recently managed Fenerbahce, was sacked after 6 months. He's managed also 1860 Munich, Al Ahly in Saudi Arabia. That's Saudi Arabia, Al Ahly, not Egypt, Al Ahly, Santa Clara, Espanyol, various other jobs in Portugal. And it just sort of is like, wow, like, why would we seriously, like, what? Why would we hire? What is it about this guy's record that makes us think, you know, he would be a good person to hire at this point?
All that winning?
It just...
Well, too much winning? Would Everton get tired of winning under this serial winner?
I don't know. I don't know if there's enough. I don't know if there's really enough there. It seems as though there's a real kind of tone deafness with the Everton regime. You know, they just managed to get it wrong the whole time. I mean, it's funny. Like, there's an article about Pereira. One of the reports is in, you know, the Daily Mail's report mentions today. Serial winner Vitor Pereira emerges as a major contender for Everton job is the headline. But there's a line that made me laugh is Everton figures are understood to have previously considered the left field appointments of Mauricio Pochettino, Ralph Hasenhüttl, and Graham Potter, all of which had no Premier League managerial experience at the time, but all went on to build strong sides in England and see the merits in mirroring that approach. I'm like, what? Everton nearly hired Pochettino, Hasenhüttl and Potter. It's like the way they nearly signed Andy Robertson, Harry Maguire and Erling Haaland. You know, like, no team has, apart from, like, Spurs when they nearly signed Rivaldo or whatever, no team has got a list of nearly signings as good as Everton.
Well, except for the Republic of Ireland national team, of course.
Watching
Declan Rice once again stride around Old Trafford the other day. The thought did occur.
Wasn't quite enough, was it, of course?
No.
Poor Ricey. Make it.
Is that kind of like a bit of a weird thing to be saying? That, like, we looked at all of these three guys who have gone on to be really good managers, but did not hire them.
It is a strange way to big up yourself.
Yeah. Well, I think the implication there, and you know, again, that's a sort of maybe briefed information or whatever, but the implication appears to be, look, you know, it's like the next line is Arsenal famously plucked Arsene Wenger, one of the greatest English top flight managers in history, from Japanese football. I mean, in fairness to Arsene Wenger, like, he had previously been battling it out with Olympique Marseille, who at the time in the early 90s were kind of one of the highest profile teams in Europe, you know, twice Champions League or European Cup finalists. They did win the European Cup scandalously then. You know, they were involved in various corruption allegations. But Wenger was like their, you know, they were Ferguson and he was Wenger in this, you know, you know what I mean? It wasn't as though, like, he had been completely unheard of. Like, he didn't they lose the Cup Winners' Cup final as well? His Monaco team, you know, Glenn Hoddle had been out there playing for Arsene Wenger. So it wasn't as though, you know, oh, there's this guy in Japan, you know. Mm. He lives in a forest, you know, like the snow monkeys or whatever. Like he sits in a
I swore,
you know,
I'd
hot
never
spring
go back.
Pool.
Yeah.
You know, and he's taking a vow of silence. It's not like that. Like, he was in Japan for like a few months. Anyway, they seem to be suggesting that Vitor Pereira could be a figure along these lines, you know. I think Everton supporters might think, haven't we already had Marco Silva? I mean, he's been at many of the same clubs. You know, this is crazy. Like, are we really going to do this again? But look, let's not prejudge things.
Let's not prejudge things. We'll talk to Patrick about that in a little while. Here's a heads up for all you Monday-only listeners. You guys are missing out on the full David O'Doherty isolating experience. Get him while you can.
No, please. Emer Healy writes, old Emer, she is furious. Because I revealed that at the end of Marley and Me, the dog dies. I mean, Emer, there's other things to be... I mean, she's absolutely furious, like all caps. I've never seen it! But it's not what the whole film is about. It's about a friendship with a pet. I mean, would you describe Jaws as a film about a shark dying? You know, is that giving a lot away? She has written a list. Films where someone has given me the ending or a key aspect of the story before I got a chance to watch. Her list includes Pulp Fiction, Thelma and Louise, Shutter Island, Marley and Me, yeah, thank you, and Titanic. Oh, did you not know about the end of Titanic, Emer? Did no one tell you? At the end, the ship docks in New York City and Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet, they have a very happy life together. They live in the Bronx and have six kids, and one of them grows up to be JFK. Sorry, Emer.
No, please.
Yeah, I think in fairness to David there, Marley and Me is, I see here, a movie from 2008, Murph. So, you know, we've all fallen victim to this when listeners get annoyed when you spoil something that has been out for more than a decade.
I seem to recall Ken getting pelters for, like, spoiling some movie that was made in 1983 or something. I think that was last year. I can't remember what movie it was. Either way, I think if it's left the cinema, if it's been out for over a year, then, you know, I don't think you can have too many expectations about, you know, walking serenely through life without hearing the ending of a movie, you know?
Every episode of David O'Doherty's Isolating is available to World Service members. You can sign up on secondcaptains.com. It costs €5 a month plus VAT. Right now, Ken, you're going to report on some sport.
Well, you know, I don't know. Have we reached an all-time peak of corruption allegations? Has the ineptitude of VAR finally send everyone completely insane?
Broken people's brains.
Some of us predicted. Some of us suggested.
Yeah, well done, Murph. Great prediction that time.
Nah, no problem. You know me, I'm a straight shooter. I'll always call
love
it
your
as
column.
I see it.
Love your column in the Irish Times.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Some of us suggested this could be a problem. This could be a problem.
Every Thursday.
I mean, there's Jim Piddock of the, an actor, with the Crystal Palace Supporters Trust. CPFC should request a PL investigation into that Liverpool game. Worst VAR referee decision I've ever seen. Either VAR doesn't work and should be scrapped, or there was corruption at play to try and keep the title race close. That's a sample of opinion on the, frankly, well, I don't know. I mean, the Liverpool Crystal Palace refereeing decisions were, I thought, remarkable. You know, and I mean, is it? As he suggests, corruption play to try and keep the title race close. I mean, I don't know. But certainly
can I put in, it sounds like I should have put in the legal qualifier at the start of this conversation, Ken. There was no actual corruption at play in any of the incidents that you're about to hear about. Now, please, continue.
According to you, Owen, I mean, there was no corruption at play. I mean, I don't know. I mean, for me, I'm like, I don't understand. Sometimes I see things and I don't understand them all.
You're just out there asking questions, Ken. Is that what you're saying?
Well,
here?
There's things that I don't understand when I see them. Now, In that game, which was a really interesting and weird game, in which it looked as though Liverpool were going to win easily, you know, maybe repeat their 7-0 from was it last season or the season before at Crystal Palace, but then it became apparent that they were every couple of minutes going to cough up an absolutely massive chance, and at the end of it, they were lucky not to lose a game that at one point it looked as though they were going to absolutely run away with, and had, as Jurgen Klopp pointed out, their goalkeeper to thank for making a bunch of saves. You know, they lost the XG, but they ended up winning the game 3-1. Now, there was two very contentious decisions. One of them was Liverpool were given a goal, or the Oxlade-Chamberlain goal was allowed to stand when Roberto Firmino was clearly offside as the ball comes in from Andy Robertson. To me, this clearly is an offside. It is offside because as Robertson crosses the ball, Firmino jumps for the ball and he's straining every sinew to try and touch it. He doesn't touch it. It passes over his head to Oxlade-Chamberlain, who isn't offside, but he controls it and he scores. But the point is that the defender who could be marking Oxlade-Chamberlain is instead marking Firmino because he has to. He doesn't know whether Firmino's offside or not. Firmino is offside, but the defender's going to mark him, and as a result, Oxlade-Chamberlain is at the back. He's free and he scores. I think Firmino is interfering with play and that goal should be ruled out. For some reason, despite access to the replays, they didn't rule it out. So that was a certainly very favourable decision from Liverpool's point of view. They then, Palace had sort of were ripping apart the Liverpool high line. You know, Virgil van Dijk looking very, very ponderous, I would say, repeatedly getting exposed by these balls in behind. And it really did look as though Palace were going to get the equaliser that really the performance had deserved. And then, right at the end, another one of these kind of big blockbuster passes from Trent Alexander-Arnold. Diogo Jota is running onto it and controls the ball, then goes to take a second touch on the ball, misses it, collides with the goalkeeper, and then a penalty is awarded not by the referee. The referee says, nah, don't think so. I think he just ran into keeper there. But the referee is then beckoned over, we have to look at this and blah, 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 and goes over and awards a penalty. And I'm just thinking, I don't see why this is a penalty.
I think I'm with you on this one, Kenny. Magaita, it's one of those ones where if the goalkeeper started to come out, and if he had continued and cleaned the player out, then that's one thing. But you can see from quite an early stage, he's trying to pull out. Contact isn't exactly, too robust. And you're always told if a decision, is there enough there to overturn it, And if the decision of the referee was not to award a penalty. I'm actually getting that. I'm making that more complicated. It just wasn't a penalty full stop, I think. But, in the age we live in, the way we watch matches, you are conditioned now to think, okay, well, if a decision has been made, there has to be some really compelling evidence to overturn it. And I don't see the compelling evidence even with all the replays.
No, I mean, what it seems like to me is that, Jota tries to touch the ball, he misses it, and he then moves into the goalkeeper. I mean, you can see he's running in one direction, then he kind of diverts into the goalkeeper. Now, is that part of the same movement that he's sort of trying to flick the ball with his toe? The leg just isn't quite long enough this time, and the ball gets away from him. And was that part of the movement that takes him into the goalkeeper? But I don't know. Maybe it is. But like, he does take himself into the goalkeeper. You know what I mean? Like, you can see that he moves into the right. Whether he's always intending to do that or he meant to touch the ball, who knows? But it's like you've lost control of the ball and now you run into the goalkeeper. How are you going to get a penalty for that? Really? And some of the decisions, he, I'm sure, would say, I was knocked down in the penalty area against Tottenham and nobody gave a penalty, so now I've got one that was, generous. It evens out. It's fair. But it's just nonsense. Like, it's just absolute nonsense. But then, you see, I also saw last night the Chelsea-Tottenham game, the bizarre spectacle of Gary Neville just repeatedly insisting, that is not a foul, over footage of Harry Kane blatantly pushing Thiago Silva in the back.
I want to disagree. I want to disagree with you on one of these, but I can't manufacture any outrage here.
It makes the podcast much better if one of us disagrees, but unfortunately, he is right.
People will see through it. They see through it if it's fake and if it's just, I disagree with that. So I have to be honest. I could not believe, and I didn't see Roy Keane post-match. Apparently, Keane agreed with Neville, did he? I'm not sure.
No, Keane said, believe it or not, Gary's wrong. So
okay,
You know, he didn't agree with that particular call. But, like, I mean, it's a clear push. Like, I mean,
it was a push. And, you know, you could say the usual.
Keno did also say when he saw Harry Kane still giving out to the referee at halftime, he's like, well, Harry should keep talking to him. You know, he's the England captain. They might change his mind eventually, you know. Which I thought was pretty good, to be fair.
It is funny how much of when people watch something, the reaction can be conditioned by that initial, what the co-commentator is saying. It kind of depends who the co-commentator is, but when it's Neville and someone with his sort of heft and he's immediately shouting it down, it becomes a scandal, you know, when it shouldn't be, really. If he had reacted a bit more calmly, then maybe it wouldn't have blown up, because I couldn't believe there was such a big thing made of this when the defender's clearly pushed over and maybe you could say is making the most out of it. But in fairness, they're both running quite fast. When you get a push at that speed, probably are going to fall over.
Yeah, come on. You know, he pushed him just to get him out of the way, and then he scored a goal in the space that he'd created by the push. So, yeah, I mean, that's a foul. So, ultimately, the game, I thought the Chelsea Spurs game was very disappointing, really. It wasn't, like, I don't think Chelsea obviously won quite easily, didn't really play that well. Nice goal by Ziyech. Lukaku again, pretty bad. Kane, though, wasn't really much better. Although he didn't have too many chances to really influence the game. But look, again, it was part of... I felt that a lot of the football was a bit disappointing this weekend.
Yeah.
And a lot of it, you know, came back to these decisions. I mean, the Man United-West Ham game. We do have an email today from Kevin. I mean, again, and we're talking about like how everyone's gone insane, right, because of the bar. I'm sorry, Kevin, but I think you might have gone insane. Although I'm not sure. It's just that when someone actually goes to the extent of getting a freeze frame and then overlaying a bunch of graphics on the freeze frame with like
he
different
draws
angles.
His own lines, Ken. Come on, let's not beat around the bush. That's what's happened here. He's drawing his own line.
Well, what he's saying is that the VAR line is fake. So this is the Marcus Rashford goal, right? And Rashford scored from, you know, it's Martial to Cavani across the goal, and Rashford at the far post sticks it in, and that's a late winner for Man United against West Ham. And poor old Declan Rice is crying his heart out. And it's very sad.
Declan Rice was the best player by a mile.
It's very sad for Declan Rice. Oh, you know, to have given so much, you know, and to end with nothing like that, it really must have been a really ashen feeling for him. But
you've always got to play well when you put on the Irish shirt.
But Kevin isn't concerned about that. What he's concerned about is the scandal of this, of the fact that VAR allowed this disgrace to stand. You can draw comfort from the fact that Pythagoras' theorem can be relied upon 100% of the time to inform you as to the dimensions of the same right angle triangle, that is. Using basic trigonometry, it is possible to establish from a football still where the VAR line should be drawn by reference to the other lines on the pitch and known dimensions of same. Where the line should be drawn is also a function of where precisely the camera is in the stance, how high up it is, how far back from the touchline, at what longitudinal point relative to the touchline it's located at. Using basic trigonometry, I've clearly established that not only was Cavani offside last Saturday night, but well off. This is because, based on the dimensions of the pitch presented to us, the still on which the VAR line was drawn, it can be calculated that the VAR line should have been drawn at an 85-degree angle to the short side of the nearest line in the small parallelogram. We can safely assume this is a straight line. Instead, it is apparent to me for the first time that VAR lines are being drawn with limited reference to the spatial reality on the ground. There appears to be a high degree of arbitrariness about it. This is even before we get into questions whether the ball has actually left contact with Martial's foot when the still is taken. In any event, even if my analysis were at 2 to 3 degrees, it's still not getting Cavani back onside, and it really begs the question of how a line at 78 degrees can be justified based on the trigonometry they can't hide from. It's a stitch up, lads. United are probably the most watched team in the world. It's not good for the PL for them to be languishing mid-table and at least not challenging for top four. Conspiracy theory? Only if you were someone who still thinks Kennedy's fatal shot was fired from the book depository. Watch Oliver Stone's new documentary on Sky.
Well, I have watched it, yeah. I watched it last week. I did, yeah, four parts.
Is it good?
You know what? I expected it to be even more unhinged than it was.
Really?
Not, I would say pretty unhinged. I mean, if you're asking me right now, Ken, if you're putting me on the spot, Lee Harvey Oswald, the sole assassin on Dealey Plaza that day, 22nd of November 1963?
Mm-hmm.
Not for me.
No, not for me.
Not for me. For me, we're talking at least two teams of shooters. One in the... Maybe not even Lee Harvey Oswald at all. He was sure he was in the book depository at the time, but did he actually have time to get down the back stairwell? I don't think so, Ken. I don't think so. Yeah. Okay. I don't think so. I'm talking about a team of shooters behind the at the grassy knoll behind the picket fence.
Has he taken it on from his early 90s smash hit movie JFK, which I have watched not in many years, but I have watched it back into the left.
Back.
Which, far as I know, actually doesn't stack up in terms of physics, right?
I'll answer the first part of your question first, which is to say that in the aftermath of the release of JFK, director Oliver Stone, 1992, the US Congress reopened an investigation, and there were multiple documents opened at that time, and also, of course, by former President Donald J. Trump.
But a can of soup, you can really put some power into that.
He opened a few files as well. So, new shit has come to light, Ken. Yeah, a lot of ifs, a lot of buts, a lot of what have yous in this case. Yeah. But maybe you know, we could do a deep dive with Oliver Stone for Ken's next politics podcast. That'd be good.
Well, new shit has come to light here via Ken. And I hope by this stage we have tweeted the still that Kevin has drawn up for us here. Because this conversation is going to make a lot more sense if you can just pause the podcast and look at what he has. He's gone into such detail that he has the line that VAR drew, and then his own line, what VAR should have drawn, which very clearly places Cavani offside before he passes to Rashford.
VAR drew a line at 78 degrees, and it should have been drawn at 85 degrees, you know, and based on the angle of ACD, BDC, and distance between YZ and angle of line at WH player foot, YZD, should be drawn at 85 degrees. So the evidence is incontrovertible.
Did he take in the curvature of the earth, though? That's the question.
The only thing we don't have is answers from the refereeing body as to how they can stand over this nonsense. So maybe once that gets out on social media, they'll be forced to.
To give Kevin his due here, that one did look offside when it all seemed to happen so fast. It was just, you know, Old Trafford going absolutely jubilant, and you're thinking, well, was there maybe an offside in the first replay before any lines get drawn? The eye test, Ken, told me Cavani's offside there. Looks like he's off. Yeah. Then once the lines eventually did come out, they had it drawn in whatever way they draw it.
We need Kevin a VAR whistleblower. That's what we need. We need a VAR whistleblower. Someone deep inside VAR to come out and blow the lid off this conspiracy.
Well, look, you know, it's one of the oldest of all of the conformity experiments, you know, Solomon Ash, right? So you remember Solomon Ash?
Owen?
he had the experiment. I mean, he used lines very much like the lines drawn by VAR, and basically
the idea was that
this is the Polish American guy, Ken, the psychologist and pioneer in social psychology.
Pioneer in social psychology. I wasn't aware that he was Polish.
Yeah, he did. I mean, he was the one who did all the impression formation. Conformity suggestion.
Yes, of course.
All that stuff. I know. Solomon Ash. Yeah, go on.
So the deal basically with the Ash conformity experiment is that you're there in a room, the person who's being experimented on unwittingly, the unwitting subject is there. They probably know they're part of an experiment. They don't realize they're the only subject. All of the other people in the class with them are actually confederates, in the word we use in social psychology experiments, co-conspirators, plotters. In league with Solomon Ash, and the teacher comes in, and basically there's a bunch of lines on the board, and like, you know, A, B, and C, and like, you know, they're all different lines, or they're different sort of lengths, right? Sort of say A is 5 feet long, B is 6 feet long, and C is 4 feet long, right? They're kind of clearly different, and then, you know, there's another line which is like 5 feet long, right? So it's the same length as like line A. Mm-hmm. And you can, it's the sort of thing where you can actually see it clearly. You know, it's not like, oh, I'm not sure. You can sort of see very clearly what it is. But then everybody starts basically giving the wrong answer. Like the teacher's like, oh, you know, what line do you think is the same length as the one, you know, in the example? And everyone sort of says, oh, you know, it's line B or whatever. So the question is, if all of the Confederates are giving the wrong answer, how many times is the person going to go along with what their eyes are telling them? And again, this is kind of a clear one. This isn't as complicated as, is Cavani offside? Like, I mean, that's at least debatable. This is like obvious. And the answer is that, you know, in about a third of cases, they'll just be like, yeah, okay, I agree. I agree with him. I think that's right. So, you know, this is the way it is. Once you see the line and people saying, oh, this is the way it is, then there's a powerful tendency to go, yeah, you know, I see the line. Seems fair. Let's move on. Mm. And you know, that's what these folks are relying on, Owen. That's what they're relying on. So it's you know, it's a sad state. It's just, what is it, 2 years after VAR was introduced, 2 or 3 years after VAR was introduced, we're already at this point where, like, the, you know, the mask has fallen, you know, and we're face to face with the reality of the corruption that rules football. Is that where we're at?
Not corrupt decisions, continue.
Wasn't for the likes of Kevin, you know, how much longer would this have gone on for, you know? But now that it's out in the open, Kevin's released it in a timely fashion. We got first dibs. But this has the potential to blow the bloody doors off this entire VAR fiasco.
Back and to the left.
We've got more correspondence on your Man City article, Ken. Oh. This sounds like something that I might have said this time last week, but no, it's continued. Non-World Service members might not realize that this went right through the week.
Yeah.
For you. And
it's not, it's not just Stu Brennan in the Manchester Evening News. There's more. Listeners have been emailing in as well. And people have been writing various pieces about Manchester City. You know, just what is it about them that's so boring? It doesn't make any sense. So, first of all, City played against Southampton over City weekend and dropped points. And Guardiola gave this magnificent...
Just to spite you, Ken.
Guardiola was in magnificent form after the game, responding to Sky's interviewer, Patrick Davison, as I'm sure you've already seen the clip, but just in case, here he goes.
How do you feel about the point tonight?
Outstanding game. We played really well, and unfortunately, the first action, we conceded a goal, but we made one of the best performances of the season.
Really, that good? You thought it was one of your best performances of the season?
By far.
What makes you say that? What did you like about it?
Everything.
So that's Guardiola, very happy with the performance.
What I loved about it most was the lean into the microphone to say, by far, like he was appearing in front of the US Senate.
Yeah, but you know, it's like, it's again, you know, it's frustrating, obviously, for Guardiola always to be judged on results. You know, you can see a similar sort of thing from, say, Frankie de Jong, Barcelona player who scored the late winner for them yesterday evening, and saying after the game, yeah, you know, I scored the goal, so everyone's going to say I played well. It isn't really like that. I mean, he didn't go as far as say, actually, I played pretty badly. But, you know, he goes, you know, I haven't always been... It's great when you score because everyone's like, oh, he's good. Karim Benzema saying the same thing recently, actually. Like, yeah, we don't even look at what players do in the field anymore. It's just like, did he score? If so, then tick. If not, you know, why is this clown still... Get this clown out of my club. So I guess that's what Guardiola is talking about there. In reality, it wasn't that good a performance from City. I mean, it certainly wasn't by far one of their best performances, I would say, of the season. I think I've seen them play a lot better than that. But to these responses, one came in from Bill Toomey, which I thought was interesting. As someone who has a Master of Science in Industrial System Optimization... What we are witnessing in Man City is so similar to the principles of scientific management which have revolutionized industrial efficiency over the past 100 years that it cannot be coincidental. I've wondered often over the years why the lessons learned in industry didn't transfer to football sooner. At the core of this industrial transformation has been the suppression of chaos by the continuous removal of variability. This was really started by Ford in the 1920s, but taken to a new level by Taichi Ono as head of Toyota later in the century. The core aim was to drive reliability and profitability by reducing variability in the manufacturing process. It's no accident between 1950 and 2000, Toyota went from being a small-time Japanese car manufacturer to being the biggest in the world, producing the best-built cars in the world as the advent. It strikes me Pep has produced the best-built team in the world with a similar focus on surgically identifying and removing components of variability, chief of which is letting your opponent have the ball. Toyota have a whole improvement system called the Toyota Way, since aped by every other car manufacturer. It recognizes the human as being one of the main components of variability. It sets out to reduce this by implementing what is known as standard work. Every factory worker, every clerical worker, even manager, has a tightly prescribed way of doing each task, which can only be changed by a formal continuous improvement process. poor Grillo, like.
That was exactly what I was thinking.
That's exactly it. Poor Grillo gets the ball out by the touchline.
Just give me the ball and get out of the way, all the rest of you clowns.
Is he going to drop the shoulder? Is he going to ghost inside? Or is he going to pass the ball back to João Cancelo, his main man? One huge benefit is that, as well as driving variability down, each worker can easily be replaced by another as each role is so tightly defined and documented. This whole dynamic of standardization and interchangeability is so clear in the way Pep sets up his team. It leads to predictability, but also a sense of boredom. In a manufacturing context, boredom is good. Boredom is a good thing, as it signifies a stable process. This boredom is what Pep is really looking for, as it indicates the system is working. I believe it is this you have been striving to identify recently. As a contrast, it strikes me Klopp prefers to promote chaos and trains his team, psychologically and technically, to embrace it. There's a lot more to be written, but the parallels are inescapable. The thousands of books and dissertations have been written on Toyota's approach. It's far deeper than we have summarized here, incorporating human psychology, intrinsic motivation, systems theory, statistics, and variability. But I wager, if one looks closely at Guardiola's bookshelf, a well-worn copy of The Toyota Way is to be seen. Take it easy. I thought that was really interesting, Bill. Why have these industrial lessons not been learned by football sooner?
Boredom is good is not the sort of thing that's going to, you know, sell too many tickets.
Yeah, well, I think maybe it's because all of the people who, until quite recently, were involved in playing and coaching football were escapees from this Fordist industrial process that you describe. They literally were the ones who were able to escape the factories and you know, get paid to play or coach football. Were they interested in making the football environment a bit more like the industrial one? No. But now, of course, you've got people like Ferran Soriano involved. You know, all he does is go around having lunch with people. You know, he doesn't actually have to do this stuff. But is he going to apply these principles? Sure he is. Is he going to make City more successful? Well, it does. You know, maybe if this is at the root of Guardiola's success, then I guess it won't be long before other people start to copy it. What else? Okay, so we got another one here from Uriah Kriegel, who says, "Hello, St. Captains. CC Jonathan Wilson." Don't know why he's CC'd. But anyway, I'd like to float a hypothesis about Man City and emotion that would Pep's mad genius creation elicits his intellectually conditioned emotion. Some years ago, I was staring blankly at an Anselm Kiefer artwork in a museum, and I couldn't get it. We've all had that experience, not necessarily with Anselm Kiefer, but, you know, before in our lives, I'm sure it's not a foreign experience. Then my wife started explaining to me various things. She managed to unlock for me the beauty and intensity in the piece. I could feel my awe and admiration at the artwork slowly gathering and then finally boiling over in ecstasy. This is an example of intellectually conditioned emotion. I feel something similar happens with City. You have to appreciate how in the attacking phase, when Cancelo joins Rodri in defence midfield while the central defenders spread out left, the 4-3-3 seamlessly transforms into a curious 3-2-2-3, and how when De Bruyne or Bernardo joins the false nine in the defensive phase, the thing then transforms seamlessly into a 4-2-4. I've never actually seen 3-2-2-3 or 4-2-4 before, and I've never seen a team metamorphose in live action so seamlessly. Trying to track how this octopine football team rearranges itself in space unlocks for me a kind of intense aesthetic emotion, but there's a lot of preparatory intellectual work that goes into it. I can't expect to be passively hit on the head with it. Just a thought. You're right.
Nerd alert!
Yeah. You know, I have an image in my head of a clip I saw of Diego Maradona last week in some sort of an exhibition or training scenario where he kept hitting the post, and you realize after a while he was deliberately doing it. There's a goalkeeper there and he's just making the goalkeeper move left and right, kicks five shots against the post from a distance, and then at the end just chips the goalkeeper to take the piss out of him, which he seems to do in all of these clips of Maradona in training. Always end with him chipping the goalkeeper
from running away from the goalkeeper.
Exactly. And the crowd, you could see the crowd reaction to it. Maradona being the ultimate footballer who makes you feel something. You don't have to think about it, you don't have to be told why you should feel a certain way, you just do. And I'm afraid that's the image that I have in my head. If you're explaining, you're losing, Ken.
Yeah. No, I kind of know what you mean. Like, there is an element of, you're always at risk of slipping into the sort of Emperor's New Clothes territory. But the thing about Guardiola is that we're not talking. This isn't Emperor's New Clothes. I mean, the points are there. You know, it's not like this is just bullshit. Like, you know, it's all sort of talk, and actually there's no substance there. I mean, there is obvious substance. I mean, this is like, no one's ever been able to to accumulate points like this in league football, it's never been done before. It's like you've never seen before. But you know, should we need to work so hard to unlock what's so exciting about this?
Did you feel this way with his previous teams? I'm thinking specifically Barcelona. Were you sitting there watching Messi and Iniesta and Xavi and thinking, nah, this is dull?
No. And there's a couple of differences. One of them is, well, the most obvious one is Messi, right? I mean,
Messi. Prime Messi as well.
Yeah. Who, you know, and like Messi was doing something amazing in every game. And then there was the kind of the context of the rivalry with Madrid. And there was a fact, there was the, importantly as well, I think the basic kind of the novelty of this. Like, I know that there had been, you know, this is kind of the next stage of sort of what Van Gaal's Ajax had been doing in the 90s, or, you know, the Ajax before them with Cruyff and, you know, all the, it's sort of building on all that. But no one had ever seen this type of domination of possession before. Like, it just hadn't, it was like, wow, like, look what they're doing here. Like, nobody, like, I still remember the kind of, all that I had watching Spain against Russia in the Euro 2008. This is Spain, obviously, not Barcelona. It was the, and this is before Guardiola took over. It's the same summer that Guardiola took over at Barcelona. But Spain, which was obviously built around this core of Barcelona players, were already showing this kind of a football that honestly I'd never seen. So Russia destroyed Holland in the previous round in that tournament, and had destroyed, I think it was Sweden, and were like this really pacey attacking side. Now they had obviously lost to Spain themselves earlier in the tournament, but they, Arshavin had come back into the team. They look like this is going to be a very hard team to contain, and they couldn't get the ball off Spain. They just couldn't get the ball off them. And then what Barcelona did to Manchester United in successive or in, you know, two Champions League finals, you know, it was just like you couldn't touch them. Like, you hear Rio Ferdinand talk about that. You know, for the way Rio Ferdinand talks about the experience of, you know, he talks about like looking at Manu Vidic, and they're there at Wembley going, like, what is going on here? Like, you can't get, you know. So there, this was,
and yet,
like,
that was exciting, though, you're saying.
Well, it was awesome to see. I mean, in fairness, like, and it had Messi, like, this kind of, I mean, there was a lot of people who were complaining about Spain in the 2010 World Cup winning all the games 1-0. You know, it's like, this is a bit, it's not exactly like Brazil 1970 or whatever, you know, there's a lot of 1-0s here, like. But I always felt it was a bit unfair to kind of complain about a national team in this way. Like, you know, a national team has the players that it has. You know what I mean? It's not, you do what you can with the players that you've got. And what they were doing, no international team had been able to do before. And they managed to win all those tournaments. I mean, it was incredible. But as it's gone on, there's one more response here that I just want to mention.
Go for it.
Which I thought was a good one. This isn't actually an email to us, but it was an article written by Jamie Hamilton.
In response to your verbal broadside, is it?
In response. Just again, a jumping off point. Jumping off point. Vanishing point. Why Pep Guardiola is football's first postmodern coach. So obviously I started reading this going, is this article going to agree or disagree with me? And it turns out that largely it agrees. And I think this is very good.
Is that right?
the thrill a minute, end to end, blood and thunder football, early and many others pine for, is indeed. I mean, that makes me sound kind of dumb.
But every Saturday indeed, afternoon.
Conspicuously absent from Guardiola's footballing blueprint, the often aloof but always sartorially intriguing Catalan, I would have gone for.
Is he
sartorially intriguing anymore? Has he just got lazy? Like, he just wears that sweatshirt now.
He wore combats for an entire season, like last season, and now Chino, he's got that combats MDCR t-shirt, which, or jumper, which is
Manchester.
One of the worst things I've ever seen in my life.
it's terrible.
Well, the journalist in question said intriguing, where if he didn't necessarily agree with his fashion sense, and you seem intrigued by it.
No, well, I'm extremely bored by it. I'm not intrigued at all. I know that that's terrible.
Well, Guardiola just doesn't care. It is funny, actually, to see an old picture of him, you know, or old footage of Guardiola when he's wearing like a suit and like a little V-neck, and he just looks so kind of, you're like, whoa, Pep, you know, geez, you look very formal. Like, do you have a job interview later or what? Because now he's just a slob. Like, he's like Brian Clough with a green jumper. You know, except his, he wears a little black Man City sweatshirt. But all these Spanish coaches have sort of gone that way, haven't they? Like Luis Enrique and Xavi and Pep are all, I mean, Pep obviously would say I'm not Spanish. Maybe Xavi would say he's not Spanish either. But come on, guys. Like, it's very, very, it's very slack. But look, I've lost the thread of the thing. Yeah. Okay. The often aloof has led Barcelona, Bayern Munich, and now Man City to a splurge of domestic and European title. Well, domestic titles mainly. European titles not since 2011. Over the last 13 years, and his team's radical ball possession style has received gushing plaudits for its redefining of how the game can be played. It's only now, as we enter the 14th season of top-flight Pep ball, that you can begin to adequately interpret Guardiola's project and situate it within the wider context of and he makes the point, events were previously marked by a distinct time and space are now assembled together, dislocated from their authentic locales to coexist discordantly, Pollock-like, on a singular homogeneous. See, he's mentioning Jackson Pollock here, you know? Who is it in the previous email? Anselm Kiefer. You know, we're getting a lot of these sort of 20th century artists, you know, who like to splatter paint on canvas, you know? You kind of, again, a little bit of brain work is required. You know, you've got to, artwork that you've got to meet halfway, you know, if you're not going to be like, hang on, but this is just a load of box, isn't it? You know, that sort of. The City players no longer adhere to some archaic principle of fixedness. No more are their positions consistently identifiable. They have become blurred. Players pop up here and there. Their location's never set. Perpetual rotation negates the need for specialization. The particular becomes general. Even the truest of all England's traditional positions, the number nine, is proved to be false. And it compares this to the Euro 2020 sort of dispersing through space and time, happening all over. You know, it's not even happening in 2020. It's not happening in any one country. What place more apt than the great vista of disappearance itself, the desert, for this year's World Cup to be staged? All of this leaves so many of us feeling numb. As early alludes to, there is an oddness to watching City play, as if you were being hypnotized by some curious magic of the system. Master technicians, only affordable to the controllers of vast wells of capital, beguiling you with unfathomable patterns performed in accordance to algorithmically constructed heuristics. No mistakes allowed. All imperfections eradicated. See, it's Toyota again, right? In some sense, Guardiola City are the most potent of sedatives, footballing soma for the armchair tacticocrats. At this point, resistance seems futile. Perhaps the most vital element of Guardiola's football is that through its dominance, it reveals to us the true nature of the reality football has lost itself in. By unashamedly harnessing the power of capital to animate his meticulously codified game theoretical system, Guardiola inadvertently presents to us the gods we too have so blindly chosen to worship. It is we who have elevated these forces to positions of apparently unassailable supremacy. That's the thing about Pep. He's a real overdog guy, isn't he? He's a real, like, you know, he's not one to be like,
Well, I think,
you know,
this is the interesting thing about the Barcelona question that Owen asked you earlier. It's like, he did have, obviously you've outlined how much money Barcelona spent throughout the noughties when talking about how screwed they were, you know, last summer. But he still did take a ton of La Masia graduates.
Well, Busquets and Pedro was his first thing. You know, get rid of Ronaldinho, bring in Busquets, and Pedro. He tried to kick out Eto'o as well immediately. But
maybe the more general point about Barcelona as well, it's like it kind of fit into like a narrative about that club that goes back 40 years where it's like, you know, a school of thought in that club that, you know, they can feel very superior about. But it is nevertheless the club of Cruyff and a club where deep and innovative thinkers about the game are actually, you know, are made to feel very welcome and are, you know, put up on a pedestal. And that's very different to Man City planning for 5 years before they hire him to then hire him and then, you know, go on this historic splurge of cash as well. Like, it is just a different thing. You know, he was an unproven 37-year-old when he took over at Barcelona, which is a club that he used to play for. There is romance in the Barcelona story. Even if you took Messi out of it, it's still a romantic story. It's his hometown club, etc., etc. And that's obviously not going to bore you as much as the Man City story, even if the styles of football are actually quite similar.
Yeah, there's that sort of, like, you know, if he was doing this with Leeds or something, you know, then everyone would be like, whoa, this is amazing. But it's kind of like, yeah, we sort of expect City to have the best team, to be honest. I'm nearly finished here. This is, you know, I haven't read the whole thing. Guardiola's football is itself a system of control. I think this is interesting just in terms of how it echoes the other email. The players comprise a complex network capable of dismantling and reassembling itself in relation to the problems being posed. Each number is a node communicating collectively through a hidden syntax of movements and gestures. A swarm consciousness playing its own version of 5D football chess. It's kind of like the previous email comparing them to an octopus. Did you see that film, the octopus film movie on Netflix?
No, not yet.
It's good. It's a bit weird, but interesting.
I think we've had enough segues for now, though. So let's,
Guardiola City.
Let's come to a final point.
Guardiola City have no spine.
Spineless and soft.
This used to be an insult. They are invertebrate. The team's limbs dislocated from their sockets. This is a football that has moved beyond traditional notions of structure. It is post-structural. But with this phase shift comes an unshakable feeling of alienation, as though something so dear to us has been misplaced and lost. So, yeah. I mean, again, as I said, I feel that essay basically agrees with me. And
which is
so
the main thing.
I think, yeah, you know, I would say good. You know, it's great to have these very agreeable conversations with so many readers and listeners.
Now, can Mead go for the goal here? 2-13 to 1-13. This is like old times at the moment.
Hurt them, kill them, injure them.
A route ruin on the 45-metre line. This is deliberately to stop Meade's momentum. Have no doubt about that. When Dublin get vulnerable, they always do this. Always and ever. And always and ever have.
That was our mentality in the 80s.
Hurt them, kill them, injure them.
McAvee.
Some Meade footballers are missing now. Killer instinct.
Tough babe, the lad is good, yeah.
Two or three players need to be stopped. Some way, somehow, they need to be stopped.
Hurt them, kill them, injure them.
Killing Dublin, stopping Dublin. There's certain things Meade need to do to stop them. You know?
There's still a chance for Meade, and Dublin at the moment are holding on to it in an obnoxious fashion. This is ugly, ugly football.
That killer instinct.
Your purpose on this planet is to stop Dublin. Hurt them, kill them, injure them.
Do anything you gotta do, they're just gonna be stopped. They're either gonna be outplayed or they're gonna be removed.
Laid back. Tough faith, lad, in for the air.
The last time we had the Athletic's Everton correspondent Patrick Boylan on the podcast was the day after the Merseyside derby defeat, I believe. Pretty toxic atmosphere then, Patrick, and despite a few high-profile departures in the meantime, things haven't exactly improved over the last number of weeks.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I take my time and I pick my moments as to when I come on. It always seems as though when I speak to you guys, Everton are in a crisis, I suppose.
That's, in fairness, that is probably our fault. I'm sure Everton fans will note that we're dragging you on after these things. But it just they I think are one of the most interesting clubs at the moment. In particular, there's just such toxicity around it at the moment, and I don't really know the way out. I mean, I guess the obvious one is just give the job to Wayne Rooney, and at least there's a little bit of a feel good factor for a while.
Yeah, I suppose there are no simple solutions right now. When Benitez left, after basically taking complete control of most of the footballing operations at the football club, when Benitez left, it kind of left Everton without not only a manager, but also a director of football, a head of medical, the whole backroom staff, and a variety of other recruitment, kind of mid-management and upper management recruitment positions. So handing him complete power and then sacking him not long afterwards has just left Everton in this massive state of flux where basically the only people looking at the transfer market and looking at the new manager situation are the chairman, Bill Kenwright, and more importantly and more significantly, Farhad Moshiri, the owner. Mm. There's a complete lack of footballing structure at the club, which I think will harm them in the long run if they don't sort themselves out quickly. I mean, I was making the comparison the other day with teams like Brentford and Brighton, and they are much smaller clubs than Everton in terms of history and fan base and stature, but they've caught up with Everton very, very quickly, despite the riches spent by Everton under Moshiri, simply because they are doing things right off the pitch. They're making smart decisions. They have good structures, robust structures with accountability. So in other words, they are basically everything that Everton are not. And I think that leads us to this point now where it is basically just complete chaos. You have Duncan Ferguson taking charge on an interim basis. getting a response of sorts in terms of commitment out of a group of underperforming players. But the football was so basic. It was basically hit and rush football, looking at knock-ons and stuff. And everything just seemed so outdated to me that I think we saw on Saturday that there needs to be an urgent solution at Everton. There needs to be a new manager in situ, and the right manager, more importantly, in situ for the next league game, which is Newcastle United, a massive game on the 8th up in the northeast. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of work for Everton to do, and not much time to do it, really.
Can you just explain what happened with Luca Dean? Because the last game that he played for Everton was that Merseyside derby, which was the early December, and evidently there was a falling out with Benitez then, and he booted him out, I guess, or he went to Villa. I mean, Dean to me seemed like he played to the gallery pretty well on this. I mean, I don't know what your impression is, but like, he put out this statement where it was like, sometimes it only takes one person to ruin a beautiful love affair, or something like this. Yeah. And just seemed like, mate, like you've kind of escaped from a burning building here and got yourself a promotion and an improved contract, and you're making it seem as though you've been banished, you know, but like, this actually suits you pretty well. What do you make of that whole Dean situation? Why did himself and Benitez fall out so badly? And is he as big a loss as some of the, you know, I mean, obviously Everton are upset to lose what's, you know, a lot of people think he's a great player, but I'm not sure if he's that amazing a player.
Yeah, just as an extension to the farewell note, if you can call it that, when he signed his new long-term Everton deal in February last year, he spoke about his relationship with the club as being akin to a beautiful marriage. So he's never been one to mince his words. He's always enjoyed using florid language in these things. But that's quite a descent from February 2021 and a new long-term deal under Carlo Ancelotti to exiting the club in pretty acrimonious circumstances, kind of 8 to 10 months later. I think the big change for Dean was the appointment of Benitez and the change in style under Benitez. Now, to understand Dean, you need to know, I suppose, that after every game, through his representatives and through a French national team analyst, he gets sent a list kind of predominantly of key metrics of his data. And he's absolutely obsessed from an individual standing with creative stats. So key chances created, some of them not particularly advanced, by the way. Key chances created, crosses, creative stats that shine a light on his own individual performance. Under Benitez, he was asked to play a much more defensive role. Benitez, his main strategy basically was just to bunker down, to be compact, as he liked to call it, even though it wasn't particularly compact by the end, and to play quickly through transitions, either up to a lone striker or to the wingers in Damari Gray and Andros Townsend. Dean is not a player that fits into that style because he's pretty average defensively, very, very good going forward, but there was just no build-up play. There was nothing for him to link with, and as such, he was probably rendered pretty redundant in the system. I don't, from our understanding, he wasn't shy behind the scenes in telling Rafa Benitez at pretty regular intervals that he wasn't particularly fond of the role, and at times he would do so in front of teammates, which of course riled Benitez. And I just think it all came to a head before the Arsenal game in kind of mid-December, where he was left out of the squad altogether at a time when Everton actually weren't well stocked. They had injury problems. There was a bit of COVID in camp. But Dean was axed altogether after this pretty heated argument, as we understand it. The interesting thing is that because of Benitez's unpopularity at Everton, supporters after these events and the reporting of those events divided themselves into two pretty distinct camps. It was the pro Lucas Dean, there was the pro Rafa Benitez, and there was almost no middle ground. And for us as journalists, we were very much entrenched in that middle ground, because we could see that Dean was causing a few problems behind the scenes, but that Benitez had almost completely rejected, in one sense, the kind of the comments of one of his senior players. And it just all came to a head over that period. I think it was, I was told the night that Dean was left out of the Arsenal game that it was unlikely he would ever play for Benitez again. He felt so strongly about it, and Benitez felt so strongly about it, and the confidence had been undermined on both sides, that it was basically inevitable that he would have to leave in January and go elsewhere. Right. As it happens, I think he's actually got a pretty good deal out of this, because Everton are in free fall, Villa under Gerrard, I suppose, upwardly mobile. He's playing a pretty attacking role, as you saw at the weekend. Mm. And he's on improved terms. He was already on a very good deal, kind of considerably north of $100,000 a week at Everton.
Yeah.
But he's improved those terms again in joining Aston Villa. So it's not the worst result in the world for Luka Dean.
He's living the dream. He's absolutely living the dream. But Everton have already spent the money that they have taken for Luka Dean on a couple of new fullbacks. I mean, they've spent $33 million, I think, already in this window. This is in keeping with their massive spending of recent years. So Vitaly Mykolenko from Dinamo Kiev, Nathan Patterson from Rangers. So a Ukrainian international left-back and a Scottish international right-back. Now, these guys might turn out to be good players. Let's wait and see. They, you know, not a lot of Everton sightings have in recent years, but this, you know, it could happen. The thing that interests me about this, though, is does this mean good night, Seamus Coleman?
Well, interestingly, Everton have been, as I think I said to you last time, Everton have been looking at a long-term successor to Seamus Coleman, as they described it, for, I'd say, 2 to 3 seasons. And even Coleman has understood that there's been a need for at least somebody to challenge him for his place and to take minutes off his schedule every now and then. In recent weeks, Coleman has become second choice. He's been displanted in the starting lineup by John Joe Kenny. And even after Nathan Patterson, the young right-back from Rangers, came in, Coleman was second, Patterson was third, and John Joe Kenny was first. I find that a very bizarre situation, because the idea was always that Everton would have somebody to come in for the here and now and maybe have a long-term future at the club, but that would contribute in the present day, would put pressure in and kind of maybe supersede Seamus Coleman over the course of a season. But for that player and Nathan Patterson to come in effectively as third choice, and for the number one in that position to be a guy that they basically decided was no longer good enough for the football club in John Joe Kenny, I think that almost shows you the muddled thinking at Everton over the last few years. Kenny's been available for sale now for a couple of years. He was on loan at Celtic last year, didn't do particularly well. Had a better loan spell at Schalke, who couldn't afford him the year before. But he'd been pretty well known in footballing circles that he's been available and that Everton haven't fancied him. So quite why, with his contract due to expire at the end of the season, he's become the number one option is beyond me. I think it also says something now about the state Everton find themselves in at the moment, in that they've signed players for the long term in Mykolenko from Dinamo Kiev and Nathan Patterson from Rangers. These are guys that, in Mykolenko's case in particular, are going to take a while to get up to speed in English football. They're not players you would bank on, however talented they are and may be, to get you out of the hole that Everton are in right now. And instead, Everton are looking at experienced heads, players like John Joe Kenny, Seamus Coleman, even Ben Godfrey, playing out of position at left back as another example, to bail them out right now. Another example of the muddled thinking. They spent that money early doors, and from that point on, it was essential from an FFP standing that they shifted somebody, and that somebody proved to be Luka Dean.
None of this muddled thinking that you describe leads me to believe that they'll necessarily pick the right manager of the club, which, and you said this is the key, they have to get the right manager, but who is that? Does it begin and end with Wayne Rooney?
I think Wayne Rooney is to me at least, is becoming an increasingly attractive proposition.
Despite the lack of experience?
Well, I mean, I'm just looking at the links with the other managers right now, including Vitor Pereira, who's was sacked by Fenerbahce, his last club, after 6 months, took 1860 Munich in Germany into the third tier of German football. He's got quite an itinerant CV that doesn't make for great reading, particularly when you look at his recent history. That's the quality of names at the moment that Everton are looking at. So when you see the job Wayne Rooney is doing in the Championship and what he's done at another chaotic club with meagre resources, I think he becomes, at least from my perspective, he becomes much more of a logical option. Whether Everton see it that way, though, I mean, he is in the frame. That they have spoken about him now for a number of months as being a potential Everton manager. Whether he will get it this time, though, I think remains to be seen. The owner, Farhad Moshiri, in the absence of a director of football, in the absence of any real kind of recruitment structure below the Everton board, is basically heading things in conjunction with agents that he knows very well and with the chairman, Bill Kenwright.
Well, from what I see, a lot of Everton fans are growing increasingly concerned that Keir Rabshin is running the club. I mean, what's the basis of this? Is this just conspiracy theory?
Yeah, as I understand it, Drabchin was there at Goodison on Saturday, partly because he's the agent of Philippe Coutinho, who obviously had just signed for Aston Villa. So I understand Everton fans and frustration over that one, and the fact that he's kind of long advised Farhad Moshiri, the Everton owner. But there was more to that than just the Everton ties. I mean, we've written about Drabchin's influence on Moshiri now for a number of years. Whenever you look at the paperwork of deals or you look at FA lists when it comes to agents and transactions, Drabchin's name appears quite prominently in the Everton side of the documentation. To give you an example, he was on the Arsenal side in the deal with Alex Iwobi, which is obviously one of Everton's worst deals so far on paper in recent years. Also played a prominent role, as we wrote, in the appointment of Benitez, other managers before. So he's been, I suppose the best way to describe him is a long-time friend and associate of the owner. He is playing a prominent role. It's quite clear, not officially, not in terms of being contracted to the club at this stage, but he is playing a prominent role, at least in terms of trying to broker some deals, suggesting names to his friend Moshiri. And Everton fans are growing, as you say, increasingly frustrated and concerned by that. I suppose you ask the question, why would they be concerned by that? Well, I suppose we were speaking about robust structures earlier and accountability and making smart decisions. Well, is listening to one particular, albeit powerful agent, is that the best way to recruit a new manager for Everton? Or is said agent looking after the interests of Everton there or his own interests? Well, I suppose that's a question to ask. And that leads you to the situation we're in now, I suppose, where you have very few people, and people have made mistakes in the past, looking at a new manager for Everton. Would you back them to make the right decision in those circumstances? I'm not entirely sure.
Patrick, we'll leave it there. Brilliant stuff. Thanks a million.
No worries.
For fuck's sake.
We need to get back to facts here, because there seems to be a bit of emotion creeping in. What you've just said really isn't true.
Well, no. No, what I said... I'm not saying...
I don't know what you're saying, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I mean,
all I make this
you
point.
If you found someone on the street...
Am I interviewing you? Are you interviewing me?
He's a god, he's a god, he's a man, he's a guru.
You cheeky bastard.
You're one microscopic cog in his catastrophic plan, designed and directed by his red right hand.
I've heard what happened to Chelsea.
For fuck's sake.
Well, this is going splendidly, everybody.
Put the cameras up if you want, let's have a chat. Everybody would think that the appointment of Jose Mourinho would have been a great appointment for Manchester United to win trophies. That they would win trophies under Jose Mourinho.
Well, I don't think everybody would have thought that, but I think somebody who didn't know a lot about football would have thought that.
What, the Manchester United? Jose Mourinho?
Yeah.
You cheeky bastard.
For fuck's sake.
You cheeky bastard.
For fuck's sake.
I already mentioned David O'Doherty. All episodes of Isolating with David O'Doherty are available on the World Service. Any other reasons to join up? Well, possibly the fact that we'll be talking about the greatest 2 minutes in NFL playoff history with US Murph this week, Ciarán.
Oh, what a weekend, Owen. What a weekend. I mean, we may have to spread it out over like three shows. US Murph parts 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's basically Tuesday, all Wednesday, four matches Thursday. Were yeah. humdingers.
It all came down to the kickers in all four games with time up on. You can't ask for any better than that.
We'll talk to you tomorrow if you're a member. If not, sure, we'll just chat to you next week, I suppose. Secondcaptains.com is a place to sign up if you're interested. Thanks, Ken. Thanks, Ciarán.
Thank you, Owen, and thank you, Ciarán.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Owen.
Thanks so much. Chat to you soon.
Back and to the left.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.